Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, July 20th, 2026, and we're glad to be here with you today. My name is Magnus Teeval. Joining me in the studio is
Peter R.H.
And we got a bunch of different stuff lined up for you. We're going to start the show with an interview with UBC researcher Dr. Jonathan Evans from the Sauder School of Business. He's going to be talking, he researches sort of business culture, particularly as it relates to workplaces and making workplaces friendlier and less troubled, particularly around issues of racism, sexism, stuff like that. How can leaders build a positive culture? And so we're going to be doing, we have an interview with him because he's done, him and another colleague have done some research into how male leaders should respond in meetings, work meetings and similar, when sexist comments come up in the meeting, and it's not necessarily exactly how you think. We also have a report from Danny Nesvadarani about a new exhibition about climate science art exhibition, and an interview with Desiree Patterson of this exhibition, which is at the Reach Gallery Museum in Abbotsford. Of course, we have Gardening with Embark, talking about our midsummer tasks and dealing with maturing plants in our gardens and what to do with them. And we're going to be talking to Peter R.H. And what are you talking about today, Peter?
Well, they got that new Odyssey movie out.
Yeah.
And Democracy Now! Mentioned about that, what I think it was that it was partly filmed in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain human rights issues with that.
Right.
But I have other reasons why you should just avoid the movie, because the thing was that both the Ilvine Odyssey were actually, they thought that was true.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't really believe it, it's kind of like, what's the point? You know, it's sort of like, I mean, you know what I mean? It's sort of like, what would be the point of the thing? I mean, I don't know if it's that great of a story. You know, there was a remake of the movie Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Mm-hmm.
And it had Peter O'Toole.
Refresh my memory. That's the one. Is that the one where he's a senator or something? What is that one?
No, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. He is in he is a teacher in an English boarding school.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
And the 1939 one, he's more of a softer personality. But in the late 60s one, or 1970, whatever it is, with Peter O'Toole, he's shown to be a bit of a taskmaster. And one of the things is that he's making the kids learn the Iliad and the Odyssey. And they're, of course, bored stiff at it.
Right.
And he's sort of taking the task. And then he sort of laments about half hour later in the movie whether he's really doing anything important. But that was part of the culture at the time.
Yeah.
I don't know. Hopefully it stopped. But I think I talked to somebody and said, hey, we did take it in high school, and I mean, it's sort of like a,
you know,
sense
it's part of the basic education in the sort of more elite levels. And by elite, I mean wealthier levels of, for an English educational culture, they would, you know, you would learn Greek and Latin, and then you'd be able to read all those things in the original language, which was, I guess, doesn't happen as much anymore because it's just,
I don't
probably
think it
not as useful
all.
To
I
be able
imagining.
To know Greek and Latin, unless you're going to become a historian or similar.
Well, at a high school level, I don't think Latin is taught.
All right, so we're going to talk about the Odyssey, the new film, and Homer's epic.
And ancient Greek culture in general and context with it.
At Peter's segment at the end of the show.
Yeah.
But first off, we have our interview with Dr. Jonathan Evans. Dr. Jonathan Evans is an assistant professor at UBC's Sauder School of Business, and along with fellow researcher and PhD student Brad Huang, has been conducting research into how male leaders should react to sexist remarks in meetings and other situations like that. It's part of a broader scope of research looking into how to create better cultures within business workplaces. You've been researching what happens and how male leaders in particular respond to incidents of sexist remarks in work meetings and similar situations. Why did you decide to examine this issue?
Well, first of all, there's like a prevalence of this kind of behavior in the workplace that we don't like. And my co-author and I, we thought that, sure, we have some research findings about the importance of confronting the sexist remark. But what usually happens when these kinds of things occur is that leaders are kind of in a deer in the headlights kind of situation of not knowing what to do. Like, there's other people in the room. There's lots of ways that you could confront. And we wanted to provide some clarity that would allow leaders to have like a baseline understanding of how they should react in those kinds of situations.
Imagine a lot of situations because of that deer in the headlight sort of effect that often, and the awkwardness of the whole situation, that often people just sort of try and move on.
Yes, absolutely. And plenty of people that we've talked to, that was kind of a response we've heard. And probably a little bit of that combined with the leadership aphorism that leaders should praise in public and criticize in private. Right. We think that maybe those two things together is why most male leaders, when we ask them how would they respond, they indicated that any kind of confrontation that they would do, confronting the person who made the remark, that they're more likely to do that in private. And so we wanted to look at, well, is that the preference of the person who's been harmed by the remark?
Yeah. And what did you find?
Yeah, so we ran an experiment that allowed our female participants to react to hearing a sexist remark in a team meeting and then react to different ways that a leader might respond to that. Right. And what we found is that when the leader responded by confronting the person in public, female employees or female participants in our study, they indicated that was the best way to shape social norms going forward. And confronting in public helped them feel more belonging and more willingness to contribute in the next meeting because they felt that belonging.
So with this, it's an awkward situation. So how should male leaders be responding?
Mm. In terms of the public confrontation, mm-hmm. what we found was that if you express some kind of displeasure of the comment, I didn't like that comment, that's demeaning to women. So some kind of explanation of the harm that the comment makes. Yeah. But probably most importantly, some kind of comment indicating that it has no place in the culture you're trying to create. Like, that kind of comment has no place in our culture. That's not appropriate for our workplace environment. You know, kind of indicating that it doesn't belong in the mm-hmm. place that it was expressed. Yeah,
I imagine part of the, as a leader, you'd be looking for in terms of your reaction is not just to deal with the incident in the moment and that, but as you say, address the larger cultural issue of your organization and doing so more publicly, or at least involving the group, would seem to support that as more than dealing with it privately.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree. And one of the things that we looked at as well was, like, we prioritized what are the preferences of the person harmed by the comment.
Right.
But we also recognize that it is an important objective to reduce the likelihood that that person is going to make a similar comment. So we also examined, okay, how does that offender respond if you confront him in public versus in private. And unsurprisingly, we found that they felt like their dignity wasn't protected and they felt a little less belonging in the group, which are probably costs that you're willing to pay in order to get the benefit of establishing social norms. But it's useful to know that because it's probably useful to have, in addition to that public confrontation, some kind of follow-up conversation with that individual privately to help assuage some of those hurt feelings so that you can encourage that person to change behavior and not sort of like engage in backlash or double down on the bad behavior because of how they felt defensive about it.
So is there ways, you know, in the moment, in the meeting, is there better ways than others of trying to, you mentioned a couple ideas, but that a leader can respond. And what are ways that might not be helpful?
So one of the things we found that is not helpful is, because we also looked at behaviors beyond just confronting. We also looked at doing something to offer validation or support for the person who was harmed by the remark. And we similarly asked the question, okay, should that be done in public or private? And we found that women, the participants in our studies that that experienced different forms of validation, they overwhelmingly preferred that that kind of validation be done in private. And some of the ways that you could offer validation would be expressing your displeasure of the remark, and then offering her options of how she might want to either express her feelings about it or not, or, you know, take a break and kind of separate from work a little bit, whatever, kind of give some options of what she might want to do to deal with how she may or may not have felt about it.
One thing you mentioned as not being a good idea is having leaders apologize on behalf of the offender, though, taking that role. How does that play into it? And why does that end being, why does that come across as a problem?
Yeah, that was an interesting thing that we discovered.
I would think that maybe, you know, for a lot of people, it might seem you're stepping up to do that.
Yeah. I could see how that would be a natural desire of a leader to express. We discovered that as we were kind of pilot testing different ways of offering validation. And as we were pilot testing it with different groups of female participants, what we found was that they would pretty consistently comment when we attempted to provide any kind of apology language. That's not appropriate to apologize for that person. The other feedback we would got on different types of validation efforts was don't presume that you know what her experience was. You know, don't say like, oh, that must have been harmful for you, or you must not have been, you know, you must have really not liked that. That kind of language presumes that you understand how she felt about it. And so as opposed to that kind of language, kind of open-ended questions that allow her to express what her experience was, that's more validating than presuming that you actually understand it.
So in following up afterwards, particularly with the people who might have been harmed by the incident, what are your recommendations around that? And would you do it? You know, there might be several women in this meeting who are offended. Do you talk to them as a group or do you address it individually?
That's a good question. So in our study, we examined group dynamics where there was one female in a group of male coworkers. So my data can't speak to recommendations regarding several women in the group. Based upon our findings, I would suggest individual follow-up would be better to again allow there to be that autonomy of each person can express how they individually felt about it. And the language that we found, expressing your displeasure of the remark, offering options of how she might want to respond, sharing feelings, taking a break, those were the validation responses that received the highest levels of preference from those who are harmed by such a remark.
So for male leaders to, you know, to avoid that deer in the headlight sort of response to something like this, what should they be thinking about ahead of time? I mean, I don't mean specific meetings, but I mean, you never know when this might happen. And and a lot of, as with many situations, like if you've sort of thought about it ahead of time, you're better prepared to react in the moment.
Yeah. And there's another component of this, having thought about it ahead of time, before I'll get to my, like, what I think is the key, like, thing to remember.
Sure.
Is that if you've thought about it ahead of time and you've got a baseline script in your head or baseline understanding how to respond, that just allows you to calmly think about the particulars of any individual circumstance and make adjustments. Because right. one of the key ideas of our findings is that you should think about what a person's preferences are that might not be what you think they are. And ultimately, I think the key thing to remember, confront him in public, validate her in private.
Right.
And then, like I said, if you have that as a baseline understanding that that's the general preference, then you're able to then adjust to the individual circumstances of the event. And because you have a baseline understanding, then you feel a little more calm about making those adjustments.
So I'm curious sort of about how you conducted this research, because it's a touchy subject, and you know, in thinking about it quickly, obviously you're going much deeper into it. I'm wondering how you conduct a research like this without replicating the harm that you're researching, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And naturally, all of our research studies are reviewed by an ethics board to confirm that the things that we do are not harmful to the people that participate. And what we wanted to be able to do is compare specific responses from a leader. So what we needed to do was set up these experiments where the only thing that changed was the leader's response. Like the language was the same, but just like private or public context. And so we recruited participants into an online study. They engaged in a group task where they were coming up with ideas for creating a new app. And then in the group conversation, we scripted it such that the same set of three typical sexist remarks were, one of the three were expressed in the meeting. And then we had the leader either, you know, confront or not. If they confronted, and they would do it in private or public, and the language was the same. That way we could narrow in on exactly what was making the difference in terms of how did our female participants respond to the experience.
Do you find, you know, I'm guessing this is sort of part of a larger set of research related around these topics, is it?
It is. We were contributing mostly to the research on confronting sexist remarks.
Yeah.
We kind of added to that in a couple of ways.
Do these things still happen a lot in professional environments? Mm.
Yeah, that's when we framed our paper at the very beginning, we kind of brought up the fact that despite the fact that we've had, you know, many years of research indicating ways to reduce it, it still happens. It still exists. Right. And I would venture to guess that, you know, as society continues to make adjustments and changes regarding its, you know, preference regarding these things, it's going to ebb and flow the amount of these comments occurring in the workplace.
So to finish up here, what would be your sort of quick advice to male leaders to get themselves ready to handle these situations in the best way?
Yeah, aside from the sort of like phrase, confront him, validate her, the other key principle I hope that male leaders sort of like fully digest and incorporate into their thinking is take a moment and consider what her preferences might be. And recognize that, don't make assumptions about it, and you probably don't know, so ask some questions and put some effort into understanding what her preferences are. And if you do that, even in a sort of clumsy, fumbling way, the fact that you are sort of like other focused is going to be, I think, ultimately helpful.
Well, excellent. Thanks so much for looking into this and talking to us about it today. I think it's really good advice for, well, for male leaders in particular, but really anyone in that situation of leading meetings. You know, odd things can happen in meetings in a lot of different ways, and it's not always easy to know what to do in the moment of the situation.
Absolutely.
Thanks for talking to me.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to talk with you. Thank you.
Great. Dr. Jonathan Evans is an assistant professor at the UBC Sauder School of Business and researching, I guess, workplace culture. What's your broader area of research that
you... So my broader area is the signals that leader behavior sends to groups. And so I look at lots of different ways that leaders might act and how that signals the way others should act and think.
Well, that sounds both very interesting, but also quite a complex topic.
It is. What makes it fun.
Excellent. Well, thanks for speaking to me today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that was Dr. Jonathan Evans, assistant professor in UBC Sauder School of Business and researcher on workplace cultures. Thanks for that. Hope you found some valuable takeaways from that interview that you can apply in your workplace if you're a leader, but really anywhere in life and thinking how to deal with these situations. Let's take a quick look at the weather for this week. It's going to be a pretty nice day or a pretty nice week, really, with weather very much like the weekend, with mainly sunny, with a bit of cloud coming and going. Highs up to 24 and 25 today, getting up to... Well, that's about as hot as it gets this week. It's going to cool off a little bit, but towards the end of the week, down with highs up to 22, which is pretty manageable, but overall mainly sunny. So a really nice mid-July week here for us all week here in Vancouver.
This is Bird Note. I'm J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist, naturalist, and writer. I'm often asked, what's your favorite bird? My standard response is, the one with feathers. Birds deserve more than the disappearing by billions and reducing them to just names on a list. But here's the recent taxonomy of my obsessions, selected birds of the moment, annotated by Y. White-crowned sparrow. Envying the brown ignored thing, all sparrows and BIPOC are top of the list. Loggerhead shrike. Stuck on a raptorial passerine, this bad boy is a songbird that hunts. Bobolink, a.k.a. rice bird. Blackbirds are my birds. History lesson. Rice bird ancestors shared the terror and toil in low country rice fields with enslaved black people. They were persecuted for eating the rice that made the planter class filthy rich so they could enslave even more black people and grow more rice. See the cycle? There you have it. Three fave birds and why. This list is subject to change and write soon. Stay tuned. I'm J. Drew Lanham.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.
From Abbotsford, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Interglacial, a warmer period of time defined by the end of one ice age and the start of another. Yet, with our current era being defined by ever-increasing climate change, that cycle becomes more and more precarious. Interglacial. Desiree Patterson's new exhibition at the Reach Gallery Museum, which is focused on that precarity and the climate crisis we find ourselves in. The product of her work as the 2025 Artist in Residence for the United Nations Year for Glaciers Preservation, Interglacial consists of 5 new installations, each inspired by the environmental climate scientists she partnered with during her residency. Through these partnerships, Patterson utilized the scientific data collected, shaping it into lens-based and non-lens-based artwork and imagery. There are images that highlight 100 years of glacial degradation, suspended smoky pieces of wood that evoke British Columbia's now yearly wildfire seasons, and a massive structure of cyanotype textiles connected and hung to form the shape of a glacier. The exhibit is a grand immersive experience. However, at the heart of any creative work is the reason behind it. And when we got the chance to speak with Patterson during Interglacial's opening tour, she made that reason immediately clear.
This exhibition is primarily, even on the introduction didactic, this is dedicated to my daughter. I have a 6-year-old daughter, her name is Meadow, and it is really my concern for her future and future generations after, what they're inheriting. And I think one of the most beautiful aspects of this past year and of my experience is approaching all of this wanting to bring forth information and empower and engage and rally. I'm also absolutely bursting with hope in this moment. And it's because I've just spent a year working alongside and personally, you know, being able to engage with these researchers that are essentially providing the blueprints and, you know, the policy and all the information required to have a more hopeful future. I just got to hang out with them for a year and see the kind of people doing this work. So another key component of this communication is also to help restore the faith in science. And I think by trying to humanize that and share this research in a different way, but also through the video didactics and the interviews that we have accompanying every single section that really do highlight these researchers and these scientists and their life's dedication work, I really hope that that is also communicated through this exhibition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna ask you about the hope aspect specifically, because, you know, there are parts of this exhibition that do provide like this outlook of hope regarding our current climate, but at the same time, you also see photos and images of wildfires and 100 years of difference between glacial landscapes. It wouldn't surprise me if someone saw that and immediately their hope is kind of like gone, just from looking at that alone. So where do you suggest, or where do you find hope in the work that you do that looks so closely at climate change and how things have unfortunately progressed in the past century?
I find hope in people. I find hope in humans. And it's really beautiful to say that, because I often hear people say, oh, look at what humans have done to this planet. We don't deserve this world. And notions like that. But I don't buy that at all. I see people doing selfless work. I see scientists, you know, taking time away from their families to do extensive field work across summers, and these inherently creative people and curious people devoting their life to understanding one little part of an ecosystem. That gives me hope, to see people that filled with love and that filled with passion. It gives me hope to have conversations with other like-minded Canadians and understand that they carry the same kind of concerns that I do. Having a 6-year-old daughter is, I think, hope. You know, the youth of this generation are weighted with, I think, a lot of complicated situations that they've inherited. But I think they're rallying, and what I see, like the Greta Thunbergs of the world, that gives me hope. And I think also just like knowing from a lot of the different high-level researchers that I have had the privilege to speak with, there are fundamental feedback systems in nature that allow this planet to be so regenerative. And we haven't breached that yet. So in this moment, I have hope, because we can.